The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
With me is Eileen Dunn, former RTE newsreader and journalist, and Barry Kenny, head of corporate communications at Éireann Ruath Éireann. And both of them are here to look at all of the stories making the news this Saturday. And before we get into that, Barry Kenny can put on his official hat and give us travel updates. Any disruptions on rail services this morning?
In our own network, everything is running today. It was a wild day yesterday and our crews were out clearing trees off lines, particularly up in the west of the country. The one issue we have today is actually north of the border, the Dublin-Belfast line. We're only operating from Dublin-Dundalk. There are just loads of trees down north of the border. We're hoping for some good news now during the morning on that. As it stands, those services only operating between Dublin and Dundalk. But everything else on the network is running.
And you're reliant on Northern Ireland Rail to sort that, are you?
Yeah, well, obviously, they it's their infrastructure teams that look after the lines, but they do appear to have had quite a lot of trees down there, and we're clearing them last night and again this morning.
Let me ask the question, because it is a hardy perennial, but it's worth asking nonetheless. You know this thing where people say, how can leave stop an entire train?
Yes.
Go for it, Barry.
Okay, it's the equivalent of black ice on roads, right? So you have the leave from the wet weather, and it's this greasy layer on the rail, and you've got the steel on steel, and it reduces the grip. So if you're on one of the shortest trains, you will feel the train slipping. Literally, you'll feel that the train struggling to get the grip. Our drivers have to take longer to brake, longer to accelerate. That's how it happens.
So it isn't that they lack the physical power to push the leaves out of the way.
That's not at all.
Right. Exactly. Eileen, do you want to weigh in on any rail services or will we move on?
You can move on.
An awful lot of stuff today in the papers about the presidential election. And it is sort of, we're into the middle of the muckraking. A lot on Catherine Connolly, the Mail leading with has a front page story saying, Connolly suggested that Russia was not to blame for the double poisoning in Salisbury.
She raised the question and she said, you know, it has to be put into context. There has been a building up of missiles right up to the Russian border. It's utter madness if we believe this situation can be taken in isolation. Now, this was back in 2018 in the Dáil.
When the dogs in the street knew it was Russia who did the Salisbury poisoning.
Two things about it. It's getting very close to Putin was provoked into attacking Ukraine. It's the same kind of logic that you're moving right up against his borders. But also, it's 2018, it's in the Dáil, it's on the record. People knew what they were getting with Catherine Connolly. Why are we so surprised?
Well, I suppose it is to be expected that whatever is available to be flung at the candidates. I mean, we had the drones relating to Jim Gavin during the week. Previous to that, we had Heather Humphreys, whether or not her husband was in the Orange Order. This week, it's Catherine Connolly. And it's also Catherine Connolly in respect of this woman that she hired who was a member or a fellow traveller of Airgi and had previous gun offences.
Yeah, which is continuing today in that I think she had been saying, well, she put all that behind her and was a model prisoner. But then the Indo's reporting that this woman, Ursula O'Shannon, attended an Airgi meeting when working for Catherine Connolly as well. I mean, there's two things on it. One, and a bold declaration on this one, Anton, as you know, I am motivated on matters Ukraine stroke Russia. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that if there is weaponry in the likes of Estonia and Poland, it's because they know what happens to them if there isn't. And, you know, German responses to Russian armaments, again, is in a context.
Well, let me unpick some of that. So for people unfamiliar, you have travelled to Ukraine to volunteer and done it on multiple occasions.
The last couple of years. So I'm trying to, you know, keep that in check. In terms of the IRGE, again, it is, you know, as you were saying, the kind of third parties get drawn in, like Heather Humphrey's husband gets drawn in, everything. I do think, though, that the parties that are, if you like, saying, oh, well, you know, we have a rehabilitative justice system. If we had a situation where other candidates had somebody who had engaged in an arson attack on an asylum seeker centre, went to prison, model prisoner, came out, I don't think people would be on the opposite side sanguine if one of the other candidates then attempted to hire that person as well.
Well, I wonder though, Eileen, because surely if you are the Sinn Féin candidate, which she now is by virtue of being a united candidate of the left, Sinn Féin has a long history of having people who are successful in election and who are solid members of the parliamentary party who have previous convictions for gun running, who have previous convictions for possession of bomb-making material. This is not something they would be new to.
No. There's kind of, I'm in two minds about it totally, because listening to Catherine Connolly the other day, you absolutely agree with her. We do have a rehabilitative system. This person was recommended to her. All of that, that's all very fine in principle, but to put someone who has been convicted on arms charges in a job in the middle of Leinster House, I don't know, raises, you know, red flag.
Well, but there again, you have people who have sat on the benches in Leinster House who have that and even more exciting, not just charges, but convictions against them.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, and again, you are into, because there's a lot about kind of, you know, peace process and being a very, very peace-focused candidate. Éirigí are not in any way endorsing the peace process that has been so successful here. So, it is, as you say, these things have been brought on all candidates, and you do have to kind of say, well, is this kind of serious? Is this, you know, something that is kind of worthy of the type of scrutiny? The drone stuff with Jim Gavin, as now I'm a drone user, right?
In the Phoenix Park, I hope, Bart.
No,
The issue was that you're not allowed to fly drones in the park.
There are various exclusion zones. So you can't, I think it's about a 5 kilometre radius or maybe a little more of Dublin Airport. And there are, if there's military facilities. And if you've got your app, it tells you, right? When you take off, it says you are in a zone. If you do it from here on out now, you're to blame. We told you, right? Okay, that's how it is. You know,
it doesn't prevent you from flying, but it just gives
there's
you the
overriding. Whatever. It'll default.
So
right?
You've read.
So exactly. Like Dollymount Beach is just outside the airport exclusion zone, as an example. Because I live near there, and that's where I go. So, you know, again, it's his job. He should have known, but it's not one of those. I think that's going to.
This because he's the COO role in the Irish aviation.
Yeah, it's not one of those that's kind of, I think, going to impact kind of the presidency, whatever. I thought the stuff about kind of using Defence Forces personnel and referencing the campaign, that was something that probably should have known better than to do. I thought it was just kind of bad judgment.
What if this notion that it is the world's single most boring presidential election?
Having said that, The Mail, I think, or The Examiner tells us that 650,000 people watched the debate on Monday night. Like, for an election that's not supposed to be raising any interest, for one that they say there's going to be very low voter turnout, 650,000, that's huge.
And the viewership for that show, what's your take, Eileen? Because you have covered an awful lot of presidential elections in a professional capacity. How does it stack up?
Well, it wasn't how to be kind. it didn't set the place alight, that debate. And I think the reason that people were tuning in, because it was the first time we were going to see the three candidates together. I'm hoping maybe this weekend there might be a little bit more fire in it. Catherine Connolly.
Was there another one? There's another debate?
This week, the week in politics, the Sunday lunchtime, which will be repeated later on Sunday night on RTE. But I mean, Catherine Connolly, we were just talking about her earlier, like she was so relaxed in that environment in the studio. You know, she was able to sit back a couple of times and kind of just let them at it, sort of thing. I'm above all this, you know. She's just such a seasoned performer.
Well, that was the Michael D. Higgins strategy for election. Dig a hole, get into it, and let the other ones rip their throats out while you stand by and spectate.
Well, it worked, didn't it?
Didn't it just twice?
I wonder, I mean, the last few iterations of the presidential election, we've had these kind of big feels, and there's kind of been a natural chaos about them. And that's been compelling, and you've been drawn into it. Oh my God, you know what I mean? Remember, obviously, things like kind of the envelope that wasn't in a debate. We remember things like, you know, kind of Dana going completely off-piste at the end of one debate as well. You know, characters like David Norris. We don't have that. We have three fairly straight-laced people kind of there. The noise isn't as much. And I think that's probably why it feels a little bit flat, because the last few iterations have really been kind of, you know, Hunger Games.
But also it kind of focused on contemporary political issues like Gaza and other such things that a president can do nothing about. So I just think the narrative needs to shift into what is your vision for the presidency? What do you want to do with the presidency?
But that's difficult though, isn't it?
I know it is. But we're sitting at home looking at this and thinking, yeah, but it's actually not relevant to the election that you're fighting, you know?
But it's a very difficult one. If you have to fill how long do they dedicate to a presidential debate? An hour?
Yeah.
An hour of give us broad philosophical vision without any, because of necessity, the president can't do policy. Yeah. You end up having to talk policy just to fill the time, don't you?
What kind of group do you want to hug the most? You know,
which window will you put your candle?
I've seen a constituency that say, do you know something? I want to get back to a situation where we've got somebody who, you know, shake hands and cuts ribbons or whatever, you know, and to be fair, I think our last few presidents have successfully made it something that feels a little bit more relevant. And I don't think we want that. I do think we want to see somebody say, okay, kind of, you know, what are you saying? What are you prioritizing? What kind of aspects in Irish society do you want to bring to the fore and focus our minds on? And, you know, I wouldn't have agreed everything that Michael D. Higgins sought to focus minds on, but boy, he did it.
But for example, Mary Robinson talked about the diaspora and she put the candle in the window. She also went around the country telling communities, get up off your backsides and do it for yourselves. And, you know, she had and Mary McAleese, it was about bridge building and she was talking about the North. Like they did outline both a vision.
Yep.
We're just not seeing any of that this time.
You mentioned some of the issues that were discussed, including Gaza. Coverage this morning of the last of the boats in the flotilla that was heading to Gaza, having now been captured, detained by the Israelis. Do you have a clear sense, Eileen, on what all of that achieved?
No. I don't doubt the bona fides of the Irish people who are on board those ships. I do doubt the bona fides of some of the others.
Why?
Like, I just wonder, is it more about them than what they're doing?
And what was the objective? Because in looking at the coverage, it's difficult to discern whether or not the aim was to bring aid that would have an impact on a humanitarian crisis, because you would have thought they would struggle to bring the kind of tonnage required and then distribute it. Or was it a laudable propaganda effort? Was it for publicity or was it for humanitarian aid?
I think realistically, anybody on it knows that they weren't going to get aid in. And that, you know, that they are a kind of a peaceable group seeking to draw attention to it. It's an absolutely legitimate thing to do. And in many ways, they know exactly the type, if not the specifics, the type of response they're going to get from the Israelis, which again helps to bring attention. So it does bring attention. It does keep it in the spotlight. It's down to each individual if their motivation is to do that or anything.
Although it seems the Israelis played the public relations game very well.
Did you think so? I mean, I don't know that they've changed any minds. You know what I mean?
If you look at the responses that the Israelis could have taken with the flotilla coming in,
right?
There wasn't overt, obvious artillery attacks. There weren't.
But you did have Italian ships kind of, you know, sailing alongside and giving protection for the time. You did have, I think, certainly disruptive actions as well. And ultimately, you've had, you know, the people being detained. Also, I see there's some references to claims that people suffering aggression and violence in custody. And, you know, frankly, given what we see from Gaza, there's the type of treatment of people there and what we've seen reports, no reason to doubt that. So, yes, they could have done a lot worse, again, even more unjustified also. But they won't have changed any minds. I think as an exercise, it does bring attention and it brings international attention. Obviously, I think we probably have a little bit more attention than most here, but you see it in the British coverage, you see it in coverage internationally.
You don't see it in the American coverage much.
No, but it's a different, it's a different space. And, you know, obviously we've got the prospective deal. I mean, this is Trump's world, isn't it, at the moment? Not that we're guaranteed, because I think, you know, Netanyahu and Putin share the trait that war protects their power and power protects them from the fate that they deserve. But nonetheless, you know, in this, in Ukraine, in trade, and there's nothing the man doesn't have an outsize influence in. It's domestically, internationally. I can't recall in my lifetime, you know, America's always been the most powerful nation, but in this way, where it's effectively kind of the pulling the strings so overtly on everything, it's
so just one thing I was reading, that Netanyahu is just reeling because for the first time he's been told to stop, and no American president has ever done that before.
And Trump has posted on social media that Hamas has, I think, what, 24 hours to agree to the peace plan that's currently on the table. And reports in the papers today saying that Hamas are broadly, or at least in principle, accepting of many of the conditions that
like
are being put
return
forward.
Return the hostages and all that. Yeah, yeah. So the other, you know, some details still to be worked out, but in principle, they seem to be taking it.
But again, you see what they don't have in the deal. They don't, I think, Hamas don't explicitly commit to disarming. So if you are Netanyahu, or to the right of Netanyahu in Israeli politics, and you need an excuse, there's opportunities. And I suppose a lot is what's happening behind the scenes, what real pressure the Americans are putting on Netanyahu. Are they going to say, there's no more arms for you, there's no more protection for you from this? Are they going to kind of give the tacit nod to Europeans to, you know, bring in sanctions, that type of a thing? I don't know. It's a hard world to be optimistic at the moment, unfortunately.
Why is there so much scrutiny on the presidential candidates more than any other political office in Ireland? It just seems so ridiculously disproportionate to essentially a toothless position.
But you see, again, because they're not standing on a policy platform, so it gets personal then. Mm. You're looking for something because they, you know, in theory, they can't come out and offer an opinion on Gaza or, you know, this, that or the other. So it becomes more personal. It has ever been thus. I mean, it's the most savage. Why anyone would want to stand in the first place? It's the most savage campaign of all. You know, it has been.
I mean, general election last year, like, we've got about 7, 8, 9 parties now. So that scrutiny spreads. You know, there's a degree on leaders, but 170 odd seats or whatever it is, 180 now, I think it is.
Oh yeah, when your total candidate numbers running into the multiple
exactly.
Hundreds,
so
yeah.
It's not so. Is it, there are three people there, and it's the whites of their eyes, and there's nowhere else to go but who they are and what they represent.
Is it something that we should be concerned about? Because a number of the candidates, I mean, Frances Fitzgerald talking on this programme said that part of the reason that she would have been unwilling to run was the brutality of the campaign. And I would know an awful lot of people, senior politicians and others, who would say, no, no interest. I am not going through 6 weeks of being traduced and having every skeleton ripped out of every closet. Is that a problem in selecting, in opening up the field to the right sort of people?
Well, it is, because you would imagine, and we can see, that you do need to have a certain political noose to take it on in the first place. You need to be just able to handle all of that.
I mean, if you look at, you know, there were lots of people that did want this. I mean, you've got in each of the parties, you know, probably 2 or 3 that had a, you know, realistic interest or shot at it. So it's not stopping.
I have to say, I don't understand the people outside politics who throw them.
Right, okay. Yeah, the kind of like...
I think if you're a politician, this is what you do. You run for elections, you're used to it, you do it all the time, and it's another political... It's a promotion along your career path.
Exactly, yeah.
But somebody who's never been involved in politics, who wakes up one morning and thinks,
yeah,
I think I should be president.
Sure, I know.
It's some confidence.
It is. Whether it's confidence or whether it's just kind of almost kind of a lack of awareness, I don't know. You know what I mean? And again, in the debate, you saw that there were two people that had been through the rough and tumble of political debates, and Jim Gavin was new.
I mean, many of them have been proven right. I mean, Mary Robinson was proven right. Completely. Mary McAleese was proven right. But it's gutsy.
Yeah. It is, and the kind of bloodsport aspect of politics overall is definitely destructive and is working against, I think, the kind of quality of the candidates we would like to see representing us. But ultimately, we had a fair scatter of people that wanted to do this, and if, you know, there had been some strategically different decisions, we could easily have had 5 or 6 people on the ballot.
And a bit more crack.
Yep, absolutely.
Bob Geldof in the middle of all that now would have been fascinating.
A lot of focus on the budget. And obviously, as you will have heard during the ad break, the promo, News Talk is going to be doing a budget special. I think I'm hosting a special program around lunchtime on Tuesday, looking at the budget as the budget speeches come out. It doesn't look at this point, Eileen, like there is going to be much cause for celebration. This is tightening of belts time.
Tightening of belts time, yeah. I mean, they keep talking about focused targeted help. So we'll wait to see. I hope so. I mean, I think we'd all buy that. You know, we don't all need the children's allowances. We don't all need some of the things that we've been getting over the last few years. So if it's targeted in the right places, I mean, I think they're working to do away with the means test for carers. And I think that would be, there's an article today about a woman saying she has to bring her 22-year-old child to work with her because she's not entitled to, because she's means tested at the moment. So things like that, I think we'd all sit back and say, yeah.
But absolutely. It looks like there aren't going to be much in the way. I mean, there's a possible Christmas bonus is being
Yeah, but the
mooted.
Fact that that's even on the table, I mean, Santi would have a lot to say about that, I'd say. I just think that'd be horrific if that's taken away from people.
And in the midst of all this, very interesting analysis in The Independent by Donal O'Donovan, looking at the rise in government spending since the pre-pandemic years. And you'd be reminded of McCreevy's great phrase of when I have it, I spend it. Yeah. My God, they've been spending it.
Absolutely. It is continuing. And that's not just in Ireland. That's something that has been seen internationally. I think the pandemic as the kind of, you know, government kind of bailout approach or the government kind of response to cost of living approaches. And we've seen it in the energy packages in budgets. You know, one thing I find about it is, you know, there's references to Department of Public Expenditure looking for efficiencies and people and ministers being shocked about that. I really hope that this process doesn't all just concentrate around 2 or 3 weeks in a year, that year round, that people are looking for these kind of opportunities to identify, right, this saving will be effective or this spending is more effective. I you know, if we're going to have, if people, and I do believe kind of the general public view is that we want to see, you know, funding of services and we want to see kind of, you know, service delivery improved and housing delivery improved. I think in that kind of context, that stuff costs. So therefore, the kind of bonanza packages have no place. And we're all at this stage, I think, a little bit used to the fact that we go through a cycle and that the year or two after an election tends to be a bit tighter and then we get a little bit more flahoolic.
But when you look at the overall rate, I mean, again, going back to that Donal O'Donovan piece, Eileen, back in what, 2016, total government expenditure 2016, slightly north of 70 billion, according to the Irish Independent. As of this year, slightly north of 120 billion. Several government departments have more than doubled the amount that they spend. This is snuffing away territory.
And again, I mean, and we keep talking about, okay, we've got the corporation tax and it's huge again, 134 billion or something, or 34 billion. Anyway, huge amounts of money. But with the rider that, is it sustainable? Are we always going to have it? So if it all comes crash landing down around us again. Interesting piece, I thought, remarks from the Taoiseach yesterday, all the talk about the VAT being reduced for the hospitality sector. And, it, you know, the talk has been about protecting jobs and how difficult it is to do business and all the rest of it. The Taoiseach saying yesterday, the customers need to see a reduction in their bills if this goes through.
And according to John Burns, the what you're saying is echoed. Bumper corporation tax receipts propping up the exchequer for over a decade are set to continue next year. In other words, the only reason that we are able to sustain this kind of government expenditure is by virtue of the monies provided by Microsoft and Apple and Pfizer and Lilly and all of the rest.
Which brings us back to the power of the man in the White House and, you know, that being completely dependent on that and completely dependent on actions he may take in relation to the service providers, you know, and we've seen, you know, what he's been able to cajole out of organizations that we regard as, you know, extraordinarily kind of powerful in their own right by their scale. Apple have taken down an app on the App Store that allowed people to register where they saw ICE agents in the States. They've just taken it off because the administration said, we don't like that. I know that's a big segue from our budget, but the fact of the matter is that we are dependent on something that a very, very disruptive outside factor is hitting. So the rainy day fund, I'm sure we'll see quite a bit squirreled away into it as well.
But even
Tuesday.
Regardless of Trump, it's one of those things where for years now we have been saying this overexposure to the corporation tax receipts that we get, that we have 50% of our total corporation tax take coming from 10 companies, that it provides tens of billions per annum to support all of the essential services and that it is unsustainable. We haven't done much in being able to wean ourselves off of them.
No, I mean, that's what I was saying. They keep telling us it may not last, but we're not doing anything to prepare ourselves for that.
And you get a bit worried. The Economist actually had a fairly significant kind of article, kind of almost like a reminder, shall we say, to kind of, you know, policymakers a few weeks ago saying, like, what the hell is going on, like with this island here and the way they've structured it and the disproportionate levels. So again, even our partners in Europe, I'm sure, look at this and say, why are we letting this happen? So we have done an extraordinary job in protecting ourselves in that heretofore, but the risks are absolutely multiple.
What are you seeing in relation to capital expenditure? Are you looking and thinking, oh, there's a lovely rail line on the way there? Back to Donegal.
Absolutely. There's lots. Obviously, we've got a lot of DART Plus lines. We saw this week, our colleagues in Metrolink got their railway order. So, yes. And to be fair, that kind of capital expenditure is continuing to increase. And that's good long-term investment. And I would say that, wouldn't I, in terms of the type of infrastructure we need that will deliver a more efficient state in the future. And that's part of the reason, I think, why that kind of current crunch is on at the moment.
Have I this right, or am I making it up? Are the new DARTs going to come equipped with batteries? So
yes.
So they can overshoot their cables if they need to.
Overshoot's a bad word now, whatever. In our territory.
They are no longer constrained by their infrastructure.
Yes. So basically, battery electric. So the first line they'll go on is Dublin-Drogheda. So under the wires as far as Malahide, we will in due course be building the electrification beyond that. But in the meantime, the battery units get them to Drogheda. There's a little recharging station that we've built at Drogheda then as well. So they get their little top up and the turnaround. And back down, and we'll be looking at doing something similar at Wicklow. So it means that ahead of that big infrastructure, the overhead wires, we can get the DART to more places.
And you still have a largely silent train. It's still the same level of comfort and efficiency.
Entirely, yeah. We have 185 carriages of those on order, and the first three trains, that's 15 carriages, are in the country and being tested at the moment.
Wow. This is another stupid question. Back in the day when you used to bring stuff in.
Sounds impressive anyway, Barry.
You used to crane it off the ships and stick it on a set of tracks and then go up past the point.
Yes.
Those tracks are gone now, the ones that used to run up by the roundabout.
There's works happening at the moment. It's replacement works. There's not, those particular ones.
The ones that used to go down to the...
I know what you mean. This time we didn't. It was onto low loaders up to Inchicore. So it wasn't actually on the tracks. Yes, you're right.
Takes all the crack.
You're
out
some
of
nerd, aren't you?
Before we wrap up, Eileen, you wanted to mention poetry for Seamus.
It's Saturday, so for a bit of light relief, the Irish Times publishes an previously unpublished and beautiful poem by Seamus Heaney called Ribbons. It's about his sisters and a photographer coming to their school. There's a new collection of Seamus Heaney's poetry, and it features several previously unpublished poems and pieces chosen by the family. So something for the stocking, as we were.
Oh, we're not there yet. Don't even say it. Don't start that crack. Eileen, thank you very much. Eileen Dunn, former RTÉ newsreader and journalist, and Barry Kenny, head of corporate communications at Éireann Ró Éireann.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.